This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. After the Civil War, Southern land was subdivided and sold to former slaves. Oberlin Village in Raleigh was made of several of these parcels. It was established in 1866, one of the first freedmen communities in that city. Oberlin's history has largely been overlooked, and in more recent years, development has erased evidence of that historic community. A new sculpture called Oberlin Rising commemorates its history. Thomas Sayre is the artist who created this sculpture, and he's with us now. Welcome back, Thomas.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Howard Kraft, a poet and a playwright, as well as an arts educator, his poems are embedded in the landscape of Oberlin Rising. Welcome back, Howard.
Good to be here, Frank.
Thomas, tell us a little bit about Oberlin, about this community. What did you know about the history? Because I know you had to do research to do this sculpture.
Well, the history is, as you said, an early freedmen's community that in about 1870 they were somewhere between 700 and 1,000 freed slaves and their families tilling the land right there and became well known in Raleigh and beyond as a community well educated, a lot of military service and craftsmen of various sorts.
How'd you get the name Oberlin, Howard?
Oh, man, that's a great story. The freedmen who started the community, James H. Harris, went to Oberlin College in Ohio, which was known for abolitionists. And when he came back to Raleigh, he decided to name the community after the college where he received that free education, that supported the abolishment of slavery.
Yeah, and as you talked about, Thomas, the number of craftsmen, the people who came from there, many of them went on to live noteworthy lives, but all of them engaged in certainly the economy of the time, right? Give us a fuller picture of kind of what was going on in that community while I was there.
Well, they tilled the land and grew their own food initially. They were well known as masons, brick and stone masons. Mm-hmm. They were well known as producing teachers, had their own school, their own university, and continue to be highly educated. The community prized that as a value, and that's persisted for generations.
We're talking about this in the past tense, Howard. What happened to that community?
Well, unfortunately, kind of what happens to a lot of prospering African-American communities, you know. They put a highway through it. Mm. So
Wade Avenue,
in Durham, yeah. The Haytie, you know, Black Wall Street. We put 147 on. Right. 147 was put through that, and that's basically what happened. But so, the community is still there, yeah. And that's very important for people to know. It's not like the community just disappeared. Mm-hmm. That had a devastating impact.
So tell us about this effort and how you got brought into it, Thomas, the effort to commemorate the community that had been there or certainly some of the structures that were lost.
Well, it started out on a piece of land owned by the York family that was kind of left over from the 80s rules about how you build buildings in a suburban way back from the road. So there was a piece of land right on Oberlin Road that a building could not be built on. And Smeeds York had the idea of, gee, wouldn't it be nice to put art there?
And this is one of the big development family, one of the big developers in Raleigh, right? You're talking
correct,
about
and owner family. Of Cameron Village.
Yes.
Smeeds had this idea, and it didn't take too long before both of us realized that this was kind of sacred earth here, sacred dirt, and that the project needed to be about that sacrality. It needed to be about the community. And so we assembled, Smeeds assembled a group of mostly elders from the community who became really my client. And the design emanated from there.
Well, talk about the design and your approach to sculpture in general and how you apply that to this project.
Well, the key for me came from the cemetery, which is less than 100 yards away as a crow flies. And the cemetery has, we don't exactly know how many, but many hundreds, 500 or 600 people, initially slaves buried there. And there's a little sign there that says, don't pick up any stones or rocks or pieces of wood because they could be markers for the unmarked. And that became the key to this whole design. We all need to be marked, and this community needs to be marked. Those folks, those unmarked folks, need to be marked. So that was essentially what we've done.
So how do you do that? I mean, you've got that. You're starting to internalize or feel, mm-hmm. right, the sacredness of the land, but you're also listening to people, and you're an artist in your own right. How do you bring all that together and end up with a sculpture?
Well, there's leaps of faith along the way, and the initial leaps didn't go over that well for reasons I now understand deeply. I learned from the community. I learned what it needs to be about.
So give us an example. What you came with a prototype or a drawing? Or?
Well, a lot of it was the language mm-hmm. I was using. I sensed that an earth casting was what we needed to do there, at least the most prominent. I mean, in some ways, the audience is not the community, but it's the well over 3,000 cars a day that drive by there. And that's a serious audience. And so the tallest part are these large earth cast kind of columns that were cast in furrows right there where there had once been agricultural furrows. So we recreated that shape. And so out of the earth comes this little community of sculptures that are aiming right at, exactly at the, you can't see it from me. From there, but from they're aiming right at the cemetery,
and the conversation that went around it. How did that inform your art and this idea that you had that's ultimately come to life as a sculpture?
Well, I learned that the community wanted to be marked and wanted specific information and stories to be part of this, and so it occurred to me I needed to call my friend Howard Kraft up, who is a word master and is familiar with the overall story, not Oberlin specifically. And so embedded in the landscape, as you said, are a lot of the stories and people and dates that the community wanted to see, but not as a kind of didactic narrative, but as poems, which are much more open-ended and allow you to kind of range around with these stories and ideas and form your own conclusions.
So what did you learn, Howard, in doing the research for this? Because if I know you, you spent a lot of time trying to figure out who these people are and what they did.
You learn things specifically about the people. You get to have the pleasure of interviewing. One of the gentlemen that I had the pleasure of interviewing had, served two tours in Vietnam. And one of the reasons was because he didn't want his little brother to go. And then a couple of other people I met had were part of desegregating, Daniels mm-hmm. Middle School in Raleigh. And then Joe Holt with Broughton. So just, these are really spectacular, incredible people. And so being around them, I learned a lot about, humility and grace and perseverance. So it was an incredible experience. I got way more out of the experience than the people got by, from what I wrote on the monument.
Nonetheless, you did write some things. I wonder if you can give us a sample of what you wrote.
Sure, I'll read a little bit. This is... the first part of the ode, I won't read the whole thing. So this is Oberlin Rising. Here, along what was once old Hillsboro Road, black makers fired the flame that fashioned this place. $50 for a parcel of dream measured out by the acre. Hear the hammer, boards banged into place, bricks slapped with mortar, the drayman's horse clopping pulling cart, with supplies for these pioneers of the possible, free men and women, beacons of light, a mighty people rising. And so there are three parts to that ode that are spaced out throughout the memorial. And then there's a visitor's note as you come in that says, as you stand here or sit and gaze and breathe in the history of this place. Know that it was born of sacrifice and struggle, and it was made and is made from lives of people who loved and lived, built and dreamed and do so still. Let their spirit lend strength to your own, so when you walk away, a piece of Oberlin travels with you. And I think that was the ultimate goal of what we were trying to do with the art piece.
What was the reaction of the people who you talked with when you told them, hey, we're doing this project and we're gonna make a monument and some pause? I'll start with you, Howard.
Well, I came in later. The project was already in swing when Thomas invited me. But the feeling that I got was that these people are very passionate about their community, and it would be wise on my part not to mess it up because there could be consequences.
Well, Thomas, how about you? And I want to be very honest about this. This white guy walks in and says, I understand there's this story to be told, and they've asked me to help tell it. That can be an awkward moment. How did that go initially, or was it not?
Well, I think whatever awkwardness there was me groping around with narratives that weren't theirs. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sculptures that are there, they were a little different initially, but the scale they are, the number they are, that they're earth castings. I mean, that was kind of an early idea, but I initially saw them as a group of kind of figures heading off in a positive and unified direction, and it was all very positive, and it belied the fact that the story is not all positive, and it continues to not all be positive, and that it needed, as I said, need to be more about marking that we have been here, we're still here, but we've made a difference to this larger community, and by God, we want that to be told. And it took me a while to get that.
You know, it's interesting if we think in this moment about all the debate over Confederate monuments and the way we memorialize our past in public spaces. Where does this fit in that conversation, do you think?
I think the process of how this was made and what it does is profoundly different. This came, the memorialization, and I think it is that in part, came out of the elders, and not just the elders, but they were part of it. And it's not holding up one guy, usually a guy, especially on a horse, that sort of holds sway and lords over us. It's a public place that you can enter and get some relief from Oberlin Road, which is increasingly congested, and hang out and read and absorb Howard's words, which are a kind of lens through which the community spoke.
But it's, and at the same time, it is abstract. And sometimes when people want their past memorialized, they have a vision of this, of a guy on a horse, the guy who saved us, the heroes who we all remember and talk about. So what's been the response? I'll stay with you, Thomas, then I want to talk to Howard about that.
Well, I think there was some talk about, Can't we have figures, a la bronze figures, you know, hoeing the ground or whatever? And I think the community itself grew in this process and came to realize the complexity of the audiences involved. That it wasn't just them, and that often abstraction is a way of telling a more profound story than a kind of literal narrative that gets acted out by bronze figures.
What about the words? The poetry is lovely, but if you're expecting those, you know, sort of didactic descriptions, names and dates that you see in the museums, again, that might be not what folks wanted. How did they respond to the poetry?
Well, I did a combination of types of poems. So we have the odes, but I chose a form called the loon, which is a relatively new poetic form. It comes about in the 60s. And I learned this form from my mentor, Philip Shabazz, a poet. And anyway, what a loon is it's three lines, but instead of counting syllables, you count words. So a loon is, 3-5-3, three words, five words, three words. And then instead of being locked in to being about nature, a loon can be about anything. So to me, it kind of represented how on the Oberlin community, you have a community under segregation, under these restrictions, yet they're still able to create something their own and something very beautiful. So I thought that these little snippets could kind of do some of that concrete work. For example, porch talk. Brown folks sit, people watch, and story talk most summer nights. Or something very literal. James H. Harris named this place after Oberlin College in Ohio, home to abolitionists. So you have several of these like one-hitter pieces focused on those different aspects of the community, people from the community, and then the more abstract ode. And then you have Thomas's incredible structures coming out from the ground. And then we have an amazing landscape artist who worked on the project, Catherine, and her work. Just so it all, it's like three parts that kind of all go together to tell the story.
Where do you think this fits in this conversation about public memorialization?
Well, I agree with Thomas. This is something that a community came together to do. And maybe, you know, Thomas will talk a little bit about Smee York's relationship with the Hope family and that whole thing, which is very interesting. But, you know, with reference to the Confederate monuments, the biggest difference is, you know, the purpose of the Oberlin Project is not to instill fear or intimidate another group of people. It's to celebrate, you know, what human beings can do when, you know, they come together as community. That's the major difference.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Howard Kraft, poet, playwright, arts educator. Thomas Sayer, an artist who created the Oberlin Rising sculpture. Howard's poetry is embedded in that installation. The dedication of Oberlin Rising is Saturday, April 21st at 11 o'clock, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you both for being on the program.
Frank, pleasure nice to be here. Thanks, Frank.
The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.